Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention, please? Good evening.
You're listening to Straight Talk with Dean and Mark. We thank you for tuning in and hope you enjoy another exciting episode of our show.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Straight Talk with Dean and Mark. We have now reached the month, man. 2021 is going by rather quickly. But, you know what? It's the sick man, Dean Geronimo. I'm here in the studio, and just perusing the news, and I see that Bill and Melinda Gates announced that they are actually getting divorced. So Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates, who's worth an estimated $130 billion, and his wife Melinda are getting a divorce after 27 years of marriage, the couple announced Monday in a joint statement. After a great deal of thought and a lot of work on our relationship, we made the decision to end our marriage. A statement from the billionaire philanthropist couple, tweeted from both of their personal Twitter accounts at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, read: "Over the last 27 years, we have raised three incredible children. Foundation that works all over the world to enable all people to lead healthy, productive lives," the statement goes on. "We continue to share a belief that in that mission, and we will continue our work together at the foundation, but we no longer believe we can grow together as a couple in this next phase of our lives. We ask for space and privacy for our family as we begin to navigate this new life." Now, the couple have three children: Jennifer, 25, Rory, 21, and Phoebe, 18, who live mostly private lives. Jennifer Gates is the only one of her siblings with a public Instagram account and made a post about her parents' divorce Monday afternoon, where she acknowledged the news has been challenging and thanked loved ones for their support. It's unclear if the Gates have a prenuptial agreement, but the New York Times 27 wrote they are reported to have one. Bill Gates, he is the world. Fortune is the co-founder of Microsoft. He started in 1975, about 20 years before he tied the knot with Melinda. He accumulated a great deal of wealth while married to Melinda Gates. The split could shape up to be one of the biggest divorces of all time. Now, when Jeff Bezos and Mackenzie Scott announced their divorce in 2019, the novelist became the richest woman in the world when she gained $38 billion from the split. About a quarter of the couple's $137 billion net worth at the time. Bill and Melinda Gates started dating back in 1987 after meeting at a trade show in New York before getting married on New Year's Eve in 1994 in Hawaii, TMZ reported. Melinda Gates briefly worked for the company in their marketing department before she was appointed as general manager of information products in the early 90s. She left the company in 1996 so she could focus on starting a family. Now, in 2000, the couple started the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and have since donated about $50 billion to charity for initiatives across the globe. Amid the COVID-19 pandemic, the Gates Foundation has donated $1.75 billion to fighting the virus, the bulk of which went to the production and procurement of crucial medical supplies, the nonprofit announced in December. The foundation released a statement about the divorce following the couple's announcement that said the two will both remain co-chairs and trustees of the organization. No changes to their roles or the organization are planned. They will continue to work together to shape and approve foundation strategies, advocate for the foundation's issues, and set the direction, the statement said. Now, that's going to be an interesting working relationship. I've been married to somebody for almost three decades, And now you're deciding to go your separate ways. You're going to work together on the foundation. We'll wait and see how that actually is going to work out. It'll be interesting, but who knows? They may just make it work, you know? Well, we'll see. And then in another, this is a article right here. And give me a second to pull it up because I'm trying to pull a whole thing up. And just like in the news, news can be real weird and deceiving, and so can these little things right here. But a woman punched a flight attendant, man, and, you know, kind of lost it. Goes berserk on Miami to New York flight, punches the flight attendant. So Brooklyn woman allegedly slugged a flight attendant on an American Airlines flight to New York from Miami on Sunday and was cuffed for the rest of the journey by off-duty NYPD cop. How lucky are you right there, you know? Shanasia Campbell was hit with federal charges after prosecutors alleged she attacked the airline worker twice in a matter of minutes as the jet made its way up the East Coast. Campbell reportedly proclaimed, "Cops aren't going to do anything to me," during the assault, which began when she followed another flight attendant to the crew area of the plane, yelling at the flight attendant for not picking up her garbage, a criminal complaint filed Monday. Wow. The incident's eventual victim approached in an attempt to separate the two women, and then Campbell then allegedly accused the second flight attendant of pushing her before punching a woman with closed fists and pulling on her head. Campbell walked toward the bathroom in another section to argue with other passengers, then returned to her victim and struck again, the feds alleged. The defendant stated to the victim that the cops aren't going to do anything to me, Court Fowler said. Campbell resumed swinging, and the two women fell to the floor, where Campbell attempted to pull up or remove the victim's dress. An off-duty NYPD cop on the plane intervened and placed Campbell in handcuffs. The flight crew requested and were denied permission to land immediately, and Campbell was arrested upon arrival at Kennedy Airport, Queens. The alleged assailant appeared Monday after Brooklyn Federal Court on charges of interfering with flight crew members and attendants. She was set to be released on a $15,000 bond. A rep for American Airlines said Campbell refused to comply with the federal face mask requirement. "Violence of any kind is not tolerated by American," the airline said in a statement. "We thank our crew members and law enforcement for their quick action, both on board and at the airport, to ensure the safety of our customers and crew members." So I guess you won't be flying for a while unless you're flying back and forth to court. And in New York, you know, you don't even need a plane for all that. But anyway, again, it's the six-man Dean Geronimo. I'm in the studio from NJ to NC with my right-hand man, Mark Lee. So, Mark, tell me what's good in your neck of the woods, my brother.
Oh, quiet over here. You know, we had a little bit of rain earlier today, and of course I was doing the other shows and everything. Actually, ironically, I had ended on that same note that you began with the whole Melinda Gates and Bill Gates divorce and all of that, because I had realized, you know, Melinda attended Duke University and has some strong Duke ties. Some of the Gates Foundation money has gone to Duke organizations and Duke institutions, so I think he still has some associations and some friends here in this area. So I was asking, I wonder whether he's going to start giving more money to Duke, or whether he's going to start giving less money, or how this is all going to work out. So, like I said, you were beginning with that story, and I was ending with that story. So it was interesting. We had a little bit of that synergy going on at the same time. But definitely, it's a major divorce, and folks will be trying to figure out what's going on. I had read somewhere recently that they had actually, I don't know whether there was a prenup, but I had read that they had basically said that the kids are going to have to earn their own money, so the parents are not just going to let them inherit the wealth just off the top of their head. And so apparently there was something that I had read that they're going to, I'm sure they'll get some money in more than me or you can ever think about, but apparently they're not going to get all of the money that they would get in usually.
You know what? It might be one of those things where the amount of money that we're going to leave you when we leave this earth depends on how much work you actually did before we passed. So if you sit around and do nothing, we'll leave you nothing. If you, you know, work a little bit, we'll leave you a little bit. If you work a lot, We just might bless you so you don't have to work again. So I can understand the concept because they don't want them to be dependent on that money. You know, go out here, earn a living for yourself. Yes, you grew up privileged. Yes, you grew up, but you know what? Now it's time for you to fly. And it's up to you to do what you think is right and show us what we know is right. And then we'll decide from there.
That would make a lot of sense. I can see that where they might be sitting there going like, you know, and I'm sure they'll probably be working in the company, or they might even be working for a competitor company, but they're probably going to let them, as you said, get a chance to fly on their own, get a chance to see what's going on in that regard. But, you know, speaking of folks that had some to be kicking themselves and everything, I've been reading because, you know, I told you, I think, on one of our episodes that I'm a fan of sports, all kinds of sports, but definitely a fan of horse racing. So I'm a fan of horse racing, and I was checking the backstory for the winner of the horse race. So, you know, that horse is probably, what, worth $1 million now between stud prices and between some of the other things that go on after you win a race and everything. We don't even know whether they're going to win the rest of the Triple Crown, but they've won at least part of what they need to win. And I had read that that horse was originally sold, not to the people that bought it, but it was sold to them, I think, for $30,000, which is actually cheap in horse and farm prices and everything. But the original price, it was part of a divorce settlement. So apparently the woman was getting divorced. They were selling the farmland and everything. So that horse was originally sold, hold your breath here, for the amount of some apartment. That horse was originally sold for $1,000. So the $1,000 horse is now
wow.
going to be worth. And
you know
what? You know that woman that sold that house in divorce has got to be kicking herself in her backside going like, I cannot believe I sold that horse for $1,000. And apparently only one person did for the horse.
You know what? She may come back with a claim that she didn't intend to sell the horse, but she meant to lease him out. You know, it'll be something crazy like that. Like, no, you sold it for $1,000. You had no need for the horse, so you gave it away. Someone else saw the value in your quote-unquote junk. And from there now, that horse is worth a whole lot more. And you threw it away. You know, what they say is one person's trash is another person's treasure. And that's a prime example of that. Like, I mean, you never know how things are going to turn out. But then next thing you know, hey, look at it now. You know, look at it now.
Exactly. Look at it now. But that was just one of the prime examples of a horse that just amazed people and surprised people and all of that. So I'm curious to see, like I said, what her reaction is. I'm not even sure if she's still on the planet or not. But this year, she's probably definitely kicking herself. And apparently that horse also has a reputation, which is a good reputation to have, which is apparently if it gets behind, it might stay behind. But apparently it's got a reputation that if it gets to leave, you're not catching it. So it's got that kind of reputation that like that. If I get in front of you, you can forget it. I'm not giving up.
Right.
So,
I ain't nothing wrong with that. And once I get in the front, I stay in the front. Like Ricky Bobby said, man, if you ain't first, you last. So, yo, we got somebody.
You know, we got somebody at the door, and I definitely have
that might
be our insurance lady from California, who is also a former playmate in a number of other things. But I'm interested to hear her story and everything. So I'm definitely interested. I think we'll have a great conversation on that line. But, you know, just really quickly, as we're talking about news issues, we did have a major funeral here in North Carolina. You know, Derek Chauvin was found guilty, and now we're going to wait for the sentencing. But Mr. Brown was shot by police officers as well. His funeral was today in Elizabeth City. And it's my understanding, you know, I've not looked online to see about the clips and everything, but it's my understanding that people like Al Sharpton and Ben Crump came to speak at the funeral, along with probably like some of our local civil rights leaders. And I want to say that even some of the Floyd family people came here as well. So definitely, you know, even though, as we've said on this show before, you know, one thing stops, the problem does not stop in the least bit. So it's like, you know, we have laid them to rest and all of that, but definitely a lot of folks were coming here and mourning this gentleman as the funeral was today and everything, and definitely folks were calling for justice during his death at his experiencing injustice in his death after the 42-year-old was fatally shot by a sheriff deputy 2 weeks ago. And the Reverend Al Sharpton did deliver the eulogy. So it was Reverend Sharpton that delivered the eulogy for him and all of that. So definitely he delivered the eulogy, liking the authorities' lack of transparency in Brown's killing to a shell game, the classic street game that is secretly rigged among those participating. He said, "I know a card game when I see it. Release the whole tape and let the folks see what happened to Andrew Brown. Don't talk to us like we're stupid. If there's nothing on the tape, there won't be nothing on it in 45 days. And if there's something on it in 45 days, there's something on it today." So definitely he was speaking at that funeral. The family attorney, Benjamin Crump, who was also the family attorney for the case against Chauvin and everything, he was there as well. So definitely a lot of notables were here as the man was laid to rest some 2 weeks after the incident. And like I said, a lot of folks still got questions and all of that. So hopefully these questions will be answered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, hopefully they will. Hopefully they will. We'll wait and see what comes of it. And then we'll just be able to, you know, move on from there. But hopefully they do get some answers there.
Yeah, I hope so. Definitely, definitely. So I understand we've got a guest. So I want to see what Ms. Driggs has got going on in their world. Because like I said, she has gone from being a celebrity of one sort to a celebrity of another sort. Because she's making all kinds of money in the insurance field. So this ought to be a fascinating conversation, since she has done all kinds of amazing things. And I am quite fascinated to learn more about this amazing person and find out more of what they've got going on. So if you're ready to bring them on, I'm ready to have them brought on.
All right, we're about to bring them in right now. Welcome to Straight Talk with Dean and Mark. You are now on the line. Please tell us who you are and where you're calling from.
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
Hey, this is Deborah Driggs. I'm calling in from Los Angeles, California. I'm here in La La Land.
You're over there in La La Land and everything. I was just telling Dean I had the pleasure of meeting you through some of these podcasting networking sites that find you amazing guests and all of that. I think the one that I thought you had was Potted or Podcast or one of those. I've found so many of them. But definitely I was just fascinated by your story because, as I was telling Dean, I remember that apparently, and I'm guessing it was ACC, that you were originally from the South, but apparently you were involved as a playmate back in the 90s, but now you've got a whole other career because you were making all kinds of success as an insurance agent. So you've done all kinds of success in different fields. So I'd love if you could share a little bit about some of those backstories. Like, one, am I correct that it was the cover was the winner of the ACC, so I'm assuming that at that time you were going to an ACC school, but I could be wrong.
Well, guess what? You know, yeah, people are usually very surprised. It's not very sexy, you know, selling life insurance, and they go, wait a second, you were in the Playboy magazine? And I'm like, yeah, that was back in 1990, you know, and it's about this much about who I am, right? But really, it's a big deal. You know, I mean, thousands of girls from all over the world, I mean, Playboy would get submissions at no less than 1,000 a day. And in 1989, when I was shooting my pictorial, my layout, you know, it was the number one magazine in the world. So, you know, and when you're doing stuff like that, you know, I was 25, I was old. If you can imagine, I was over the hill. You know, the girls were 18, 19 years old when they were shooting their layouts. I was 25, so I was like, you know, the PTA mother or something. And then, you know, cut to years later, I get married, I get divorced, I have kids. And when I got divorced, I didn't leave with the big alimony settlement. I had to go back to work. And I never worked except for in the entertainment world. You know, I grew up modeling and commercials, and I had agents before I posed for Playboy, and that's kind of all really what I knew. And then I got divorced, and I had to reinvent myself. And so I had a few different careers, and I ended up in the life insurance industry. And in 2011, 12, and 13, I had really amazing years in that business, and really learned so much, you know, in the financial world. And what I really noticed was, you know, when I go to some of these events for life insurance, there weren't a lot of women in the room. And I thought, where are all the women, you know? And I realized, you know, like, there's not a lot of women in life insurance. So there's maybe 10% of women in this business. So I started thinking about that too, you know, that maybe I should kind of reach out to girls and let them know that, oh my God, there's so much available, you know? And I mean, for me to transition from, you know, my spiel is, you know, how did I go from being on the cover of Playboy to being in the top 5% of sales? You know, it's a big transition. It's not something anybody would expect. And, you know, if somebody would have told me 30 years ago, hey, by the way, you know, when you're in your 40s, you're going to start going into the business world and you're going to do, and I would have been like, are you kidding? What? You know, I mean, it's just been a crazy ride. And you know, I joke, you know, I use the line from Working Girl that, you know, I have a bod for sin and my brains for biz, you know? So, you know, I mean, it's fascinating and it's also doable. And I think that anybody in any, you know, especially this last year, we've all noticed that, you know, in a big way, it's, you know, that people have gone out of business. They've had to reinvent. They've had to move. You know, I see, you know, just even here in LA, a lot of big companies, a lot of people have relocated and they've had to start all over and they've changed, you know, completely their career, their vision, everything's changed. You know, last year really kind of brought it all to the forefront for many people. If your business wasn't doing well last year and then, you know, we hit this pandemic, you know, there's a lot of people that had to go out and reinvent themselves. So they understand that. And I really understand it because I had to do it a few times after my divorce.
Yes, you said, because you did it a couple of times, and I did want to get to a little bit of some of those elements of your career and your life and everything, but you've done it a couple of times, because the first time affairs that you reinvented yourself was right after that divorce, and you had actually gone into the print procurement industry, and it looks like you
yeah.
used your contacts, and I know that the contacts are important. I've actually got a lot of statewide contacts and even a few national contacts, so I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that importance of utilizing those contacts and how you utilize them. Because I think a lot of times people will think that they've got a lot of people in their database and don't even know how to use the folks that they've got in those databases, even whether they're selling insurance or whether it's selling real estate or whether it's as you were doing the print procurement industry. So I was just wondering at what point did you realize that you had this gift with these contacts and how did you use those contacts? Like
it's such a great question.
I'm guilty of having lots of them, but I don't always use them as probably effectively as I should.
Yeah, it's really a great question, and I'm always really surprised that, you know, 80% of the people that I know have call reluctance. You know, they just don't want to pick up the phone and call people and you know, ask for business. And I'm the complete opposite. So it's not something that's easy to do. And for me, it is. I don't have a problem calling somebody and saying, hey, guess what? I'm not doing print procurement anymore, but I am doing life insurance. And, you know, and I tell people, if you're in sales, you've got at least 20 contacts in your phone that are potential business deals. And the fact that you're not using that is a shame, because that's what sales is about. It's about networking. It's about your contacts. It's about relationships. It's about adding value to these people's lives. If you think you have something, if you're in love with your product and what you're selling, why wouldn't you want your client list or your contact list to know about it? So, you know, in that regard, I don't have any call reluctance, and I think that's probably one of my gifts. But on the other hand, I'm also very careful. You know, I'm not just going to pick up the phone and gab and waste people's time, because time is very valuable. And, you know, that's one of the harder lessons I had to learn in the beginning. You know, the first thing I did out of the gate was real estate. And, in a second market in Park City, Utah. And I did that until 2008. And then, you know, we know what happened in 2008. And during that crash, you know, my market was the first market to go. Second home, luxury, multi-million dollar homes were not looking too exciting to people. People were trying to get rid of their real estate at that point. So I had to leave real estate, and that's when I went into print procurement. And I had to learn these valuable lessons of, you know, be really careful. Like when you call somebody to ask for an appointment, or you call somebody to ask for their time, or you want to talk to them, make sure you're ready and prepared, and you're not going to take more than 10 minutes of their time. And that was kind of my frame is, okay, Deb, you got 10 minutes because you don't want to waste anybody's time. Their time is valuable. And you don't want to be sitting there going on and on and on about something that they're not going to be interested in. So it's really a learning. I had some fails. I had people tell me, no, I don't have time for this. Or, you know, you get those rejections. And with sales, you know, the bottom line with sales, and I think this is what made me really successful, that I was just relentless. You know, I did not, my day did not end unless I had a deal on the table. And so, you know, in sales, the odds are one out of 20 to 50 calls that you make. Anybody that's in sales knows that it is a hustle. You're constantly on the phone. You're constantly saying your spiel, selling your product, and you might get one yes. And then that's when I kind of coined the phrase, no means maybe. Because a lot of times people would say no, and I wrote on my yellow pad, no means maybe in big letters, and I live by that because, you know, business is a spiritual game at the end of the day. It's a spiritual game. What goes around comes around, and the more you're adding value and the more you're, if you just stay in line, you stay on your path, the deals will come. You just have to be patient and not too impulsive, you know, to make things happen, but to let them happen the way they're supposed to.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And one of the other things I was just curious, one of our, on the FEMA network, not the audio one that you're on now, but on the FEMA network, one of my founders on that network, I still hope to get you on that at some point, Nick Salvato, oftentimes talks about financial literacy and the knowledge about knowing about financial literacy. And he's of the opinion that we don't teach it enough in our school systems. There's a lot of people who don't know how to balance their checkbook, don't know how to do any of these kind of things within our day-to-day life, and that we don't do enough teaching to our kids over that kind of attitude, skills that we've got in 18th century value, even though we're in the 21st century. And the other thing that I've always been aware of is that I've got a lot of friends that are in our local and regional show business venues and entertainment and all that. But a lot of them are very good about the show aspect. So, like, they know how to dance, they know how to sing, they know how to do a lot of that aspect. A lot of them are not that great on the business aspect. So I was wondering if you could speak to both of those, because you did spend that time as a youth and even in your 20s where you were in that show business aspect. And I find that a lot of folks, even in the modeling aspect, don't know enough about their business.
Absolutely. You know, I have three children, adults. They're adults. 27, 26, and 24. And I can just tell you this right now. We talk about this all the time because they're learning these financial lessons the hard way. And I said, you know, they don't teach it in school. They don't teach you how to run your life in school. And the stuff that they teach is very outdated. You know, we do live in the 21st century. You bring up a very brilliant point. And we live in a time where they are wasting time in school teaching things that are outdated, completely outdated. And the school hours are outdated. Kids can learn much quicker and much faster with their device, with Google and the internet, and they can Google the facts before the teacher can even put the lesson on the board. And so the times, you know, the time of day, you know, the time, you know, whatever it is, 8 to 3 for school is ridiculous. It's completely outdated. Kids are learning quicker and faster today than ever before. And the stuff that they're teaching, it's like, whoa, how is this going to be useful You know, we're moving into a world where everything will be online. We got a real good taste of it last year, that education really, it really is a thing of the past, because what we really need to be learning is all the tech, all the financial, all the investments. These kids should be learning about Bitcoin and what that means. They should be learning more than ever now, more about politics and understanding politics. I mean, our world is changing faster than ever before. Every day, it's just, we're moving at a very rapid speed. And I'm just always surprised at the speed, how slow it is for education. These kids need to be learning how to manage their money. There should be a class for all kids, and they could be learning this at a very young age. Why are we waiting until they're 18, until they're an adult? They could be learning when they're a kid how to manage their money, how to invest. There's like little apps now for kids. I mean, they can invest a dollar here, a dollar there, and just kind of learn what that feels like. And I know, you know, my three kids say to me, you know, they've said to me at different random times, you know, they didn't teach this in school. And I'm like, nope, they do not teach this in school. You're going to have to learn these things the hard way. You're going to have to educate yourself. You're going to have to take extra classes. You're going to have to go online and figure this out, because these are the skills that you really need. You know, you need to learn how to manage your finances first and foremost, because when you don't know, if you don't know, anybody knows this, when you don't know how to manage that, that can cause so much stress and so much grief. You know, nobody wants to learn these lessons the hard way, and these lessons can be very expensive. And believe me, I only speak about this so passionately because it's happened to me. I've had to learn, everything I've had to learn did not come easily. I didn't have somebody sit me down and show me, here's how it works, here's how you do it. No, I had to learn the hard way myself. And so now, you know, I try to prevent that for my kids. I try to show them. But, you know, at the end of the day, everybody, you know, everybody's going to learn what they're going to learn when they're going to learn it. And that's the first part of your question, was what they're teaching in school as far as that goes. And then what was the second part of your question?
I was trying to remember that as well, but I do have a second part to go with that, which is kind of around that whole thing with founders and all of that. Is another one of our founders, Kim Calhoun, who just recently lost, like in the last week or two, her husband and everything. One of the things she talked about, and she is an engineer by trade, is sexism in the field of entertainment, in the field of business even. And it sounds like, you know, in the insurance, you were talking about those percentages that seem very low and all of that. And I'm imagining that you have to face sexism constantly. You were part of a, you know, featured on a sexual magazine, and probably adds to the sexism. So I was just wondering your thoughts about sexism and how you have dealt with it, and even how you deal with it now, because I'm sure that a lot of folks probably have very sexist attitudes, even when you approach them about insurance, and back when you're approaching them about real estate and about printing and a number of the other businesses that you've been in, because a lot of these are heavily male-dominated fields.
A lot of these are what? What was the last part?
Heavily male-dominated fields?
Oh, yeah. They're all, you know, I right before the pandemic, I started speaking to family offices, and, you know, it'd be me and maybe one other woman, and she was the assistant to somebody. And I was like, where are all the life agents that are women? You know, like, it's really interesting to me. And you know, it's getting better now. I mean, 10 years ago, it was a lot less, but now I'm seeing more and more people coming into the financial field that are women. It's very intimidating. You know, it's very intimidating when you go into a career that's male dominated. And, you know, and then, you know, for me, it took a while for people to take me seriously, because a lot of the people that I call that were in my phone, when we go back to, you know, using my contacts, they all knew me as the commercial actress, model, playmate. You know, so now I'm trying to do business, and they're like, okay, well, I'll refer you business. And I'm like, no, I need to get you as a client, because if I get you as a client, then I know, you know, it'll be more legitimate. Your referrals will be more legitimate for me. And they're like, well, you know what, you know, and they give me the runaround. And I say, just give me an opportunity. You know, let me show you that I can do this. let me show you that I am about business, you know, and that I'm serious and that nothing's going to fall through the cracks with me. If I say I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it. And that's, I think, you know, people are going to do business with who they trust. They're going to do business with people that do what they say they're going to do and show up, you know. And when I was in New York and I was working for the print company, you know, I learned a lot in a very short amount of time there because New York is a whole different planet. New York is like, if you say the meeting's at 3 o'clock, it's at 2:30. Where in LA, if you say a meeting's at 3 o'clock, it's at 4 o'clock. You know, it's like a completely different planet from what I was used to. People are late in LA, oh, because of the traffic and the, you know, everybody's on this casual LA time. And in New York, it's completely the opposite. And I learned so many valuable lessons with New Yorkers. They're quick and to the point. If you're having business with them, they're like, boom, you know, and then you show up. And 80% of it was just showing up. 20% was the deal. 80% just show up and be on time and say you're going to do what you say you're going to do. If you say you're going to be there at 2:30, be there at 2:15, you know. And so I learned these really good lessons. And I say this, and I mean it, that every graduate from college or during college or whatever should either do an internship in New York or work in New York for a year, because you will get the best business edge. You don't have to go to business school. Just work in New York for a year, and you will get the best business education. It's completely different from anywhere else I've ever been.
Well, I can definitely believe that and everything. You were talking about your kids and everything. And one of the things that I've been fascinated by young people, I don't have any of my own, but I've got two nephews that are, my brother was late in terms of having this kid. He's over 50. They are 11 and 12. So they're like in his late 30s and 40s and all of that. But I'm finding that a lot of these kids are very much more tolerant politically than, say, our generation was when I was born in 62 and some of the other generations have been as well. So I was just wondering your thoughts on that, because I'm finding that they're very tolerant around a lot of things. And I do know that you were formerly married to that great gymnast, Mitch Gaylord, which means that you also knew Mr. Jenner, or now Miss Jenner. And definitely that's been a whole conversation, because I remember reading some of the bio stuff around you. And when he first went through that transition, you actually called it one of the most bravest things that you had been aware of and all of that. So I'd love to hear your thoughts about, one, people being tolerant of life in general, and if you feel like, as I do, that our young people are even more tolerant.
Yeah, I think I'm hearing the question, you know, we have a little bit of a bad connection, but I think the question is how people are being tolerant today on political
yes.
subjects.
Yes.
And, yeah, I'm finding that, you know, we live in a really difficult time. In my lifetime, I'm 57. I have never experienced such crazy, you know, and I don't know if it's because of social media or people hiding behind a computer and voicing opinions that we've never really had to hear before. You know, the social media thing really did change the face of how we are with each other and the tolerance levels. And I couldn't believe the stuff that I was reading, you know, during the first election with Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. I could not believe the back and forth and all of a sudden the division on social media and just the intolerance of people's choices. We need to understand each other and get curious instead of judging. You know, one of my favorite quotes or favorite things is that we can't help anybody when we're judging them.
Right.
If we're judging somebody or we're judging people or we're judging a situation, we're of no use. We're of no help. Who wants help from somebody who's judging them? And, you know, for me, you know, I just get curious. I'm always curious. You know, when people ask me, you know, who I voted for, and I live in L.A., so it's a really difficult subject here. You know, I live in a very liberal town and not a lot of tolerance for red here in this little town that I live in. And so you know, people are kind of stuck in their mindset. And you know, I'm really curious as to when that happened. Like, when did we become this, you're that, I'm this, that's red, this is blue, that's black, this is white, that's bad, this is good. It's like there's no gray area. There's no questions. There's no curiosity. It's really, you know, for my age group, very baffling, because, you know, we remember what it was like before social media and before people had all these opinions. I think now it's such a shame, because I bet you we have some really wonderful people out there that would love to run for office, but there's no way they're going to put their life out there when they see how damaging it can be, you know, and what comes up. And, I mean, just the stuff that came up with Kavanaugh, you know, just something from high school. I mean, it was like, really, you're going to dig into a beer party from high school? You know, and it just made me think, God, nobody's going to want to run for office, because we've made it so hard for these good people to run.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. One of the other things that I know that has been important in your career and everything has been your role with nonprofits. And my mom has actually worked before she retired with the Golden Leaf Foundation, and has definitely worked with a number of nonprofits, and has even served on some national nonprofit organizations. So I was just wondering if you could share with our listeners a little bit about the nonprofits that you are involved with, because I know one of them involves Van Jones, and there are a couple of other ones as well. So if you could just talk about the importance of nonprofits. To you.
Yeah, no, I had the great privilege of meeting Van a few years back. We were on Necker Island with a leader. It was a leadership program, and Van was one of the speakers, and it was with, you know, Richard Branson and Van Jones and the Prime Minister from Bhutan and Martin Luther King the third, and his wife, Andrea. And so it was just this beautiful leadership gathering and, you know, just a great innovative week with all these people. And when Van spoke about prison reform and the Redemption Project, I was really intrigued. And I reached out and I said, you know, I didn't even know that existed. I didn't even know, you know, that I don't know anything really about prison or any of the what goes on. And he's so passionate about it. When he spoke, it got me, you know, I love anything that involves if I can help somebody. And when I heard that there's innocent people held in jail for a marijuana, you know, and I'm thinking, you know, we just don't know what we don't know. And, you know, it's not that we have blinders. I just didn't know. And when he was speaking and I was becoming aware, I wanted to get involved. And then the Redemption Project basically is, you know, how do you forgive? How do you forgive somebody that's committed a crime against you? You know, and he put a documentary together about that. And so I held an event for him here in LA and had people come and watch the documentary. And we were trying to get people to donate. And that, so, you know, if I can, you know, sometimes it's not only about money, about donating money, but it's donating time. Donating time, again, going through my contacts. Who do I know that, you know, has an open heart that would come and watch this documentary and want to help me raise money, you know, and that's what we did. So that's the Van Jones stuff that I've done with him in the past. And then we were going to do some more stuff, and then the pandemic hit and we had to kind of pull back. So, but I, you know, I think that what Van does with the prison reform is amazing. And then, you know, I got really involved through Our Rescue, which is OUR. It's the Underground Railroad. And it's, you know, they go in and they get these kids that are kidnapped and taken for sex slavery. And that just breaks my heart. And so I've donated a lot of money to that foundation. And, you know, because I think when you break down the cost, I think for every it's between $1,200 and $1,700, you know, a child is saved. That's how much it costs to save one child. And it's, you know, for me, it's worth it to save as many as we possibly can from sex slavery. And it's, you know, it's going on right here in our backyards. It's so crazy that that still is able to happen. And then I'm really involved with Horses in Our Hands, which is preventing these horses that, you know, don't have a home. If they don't have a home and we can't find them a home, they go to slaughter, which I believe the last thing I heard was they're changing that law now where they're not going to be allowed to go to slaughter. And so we had a big event for that right before the pandemic this time, you know, I think it was last February. And we raised a lot of money for that. So yeah, here's the deal with getting involved with charities and all the different things that I've done. I if I'm able to help, I do, because it, to me, that's part of it. The whole business game is a spiritual game. You know, I get more fulfillment when I'm able to give money to something that's going to save a child's life or save a horse from going to slaughter. You know, that just brings me so much fulfillment, and it makes everything worth. You know, it makes it worth when you money, like I said, money's a spiritual game, right? So when you're, mm-hmm. what goes around comes around, and the whole point to living is giving, really. You know, so it's all about giving and growth and contribution. It's one of my major values, and it's what I look at. I have a lot of things that come across my table, my plate, whatever you want to say, you know, to look at, and people ask me for contributions for different things, and if I can do it, I can do it. You know, I want to do it.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm just curious, and I don't know the answer to this question, but as a former playmate and everything, what is your thoughts about that entire industry? Like, if your, I can't remember if you said that one of your kids was a daughter, but if your daughter wanted to come and wanted to pose, is this something that you would be comfortable with, or do you feel that it's a gateway into other parts of the industry and other lifestyles that you might not be as comfortable with? So what is your thoughts about that whole porn industry and what they call soft porn?
Yeah. So, you know, my thoughts are this. Look, you know, Playboy was its own unique brand. You know, Hep's vision was very clear. You know, his vision was, this is going to be a gentleman's magazine. He wanted to show men what the ultimate gentleman's life looked like, with the way you dressed and the pocket square you wore and the cigar you smoked and the car you drove. And that's why he was able to get the advertisers that he got for his magazine, because it was a beautifully done, elegant magazine for men. And the centerfold was just kind of like that really wasn't the purpose of the magazine. The purpose of the magazine was a magazine for men to better their lives, better their persona, better their knowledge of the finer things in life. It wasn't a magazine set out to have pictures of nude girls. That just, the pinup girl was just like the added to it. And so I loved his vision. I loved what that magazine stood for, and I love Hef's story, you know. And so, you know, in 1989, it was a different world. There was no internet. There was no Google. You know, I thought when I posed for Playboy that was it. I posed, I did my mom, and I moved on. Who knew 30 years later all my photos would be online on social media? You know, I had that just, nobody had, you wouldn't have even thought that. That's how crazy that is. As far as my daughters go, yeah, I have two daughters. And I mean, even for my son, I would say this for all three, you know, it's a really non-gender subject at this point in the day and age that we live in. And that is that anything that you do in life, you do because it feels good to you, because it's what you want to do. Is it going to serve, if it serves you and your purpose and what you want to do, then you do it. And God, today online, just on social media, on Instagram, you can see way more today online than you could in Playboy 30 years ago. So we live in a different world. And, you know, if it fits there, if, you know, my daughter came to me, one of my daughters is a recording artist. If she came to me and said, you know, I think I'm going to pose for Playboy. I think it kind of goes with my career and what I'm doing. I'm all for it. You know, I'm all for whatever they want to do. It's their body, their choice, their life. And that's what's beautiful about it. It's not for everybody. You know, it's not for everybody. And by the way, you know, some women, you know, they're not going to be a fan of me being in Playboy, and that's okay. Not everybody is going to like me or like my decisions or like what I stand for. And that's okay. That's why it's a personal choice. So, you know, in today's day, you know, I think we live in a world where everybody, I mean, I was looking at a girl's Instagram. She's overweight. She just had a baby. I can't think of the name of the Instagram, but, and she poses nude all the time showing her real body, what she really looks like with rolls and fat and, you know, and to me, that's sexy. It's like, this is who I am, you know, this is who I am. This is what real women look like after having a baby, you know.
Yeah, and it seems like there's a new version of that. I've actually got a friend of mine that's in the gaming community, so he kind of turned me on to Twitch, and I've signed up to that service, and I've seen some of the feeds that there, and there are some women that are basically doing, like you were saying, they were doing what you were doing in terms of being a playmate, but they're doing it like from their some of them look like they're living in a hotel or a condo or an apartment. So they're literally doing it from like their swimming pools and everything, but it's them in basically bathing suit sharing what's going on in their lives. Like I remember watching one of them and the young girl was literally chasing a frog. I think she's like in her early 20s and she and a young teenager found a frog and were fascinated by the frog. So they spent part of that Twitch channel chasing after the frog and making comments about life. So sometimes it also seems like it's just a tool for people to reflect on whatever's on their mind. Like I said, she had found a younger buddy, no romance. They were just younger age difference because I think he was a teenage gentleman and she was in her mid-20s, but they both found a common frog and they spent the few minutes that I watched that Twitch talking about the frog.
Yeah. This is what I'm saying, and then there's that other site that I know a lot of the playmates, they use it off of Twitter. Oh, shoot. What's it called? You know, where you can post videos and people join. They can join your private room, and you can post videos. You can be in lingerie. You can talk. You can – I forget what it's called, but anyway, it's off of Twitter. And, you know, that has kind of made up for, you know, these girls.
Oh, it's off of Twitter. It might be Periscope, because I know Periscope was bought by Twitter, and that's a video platform, so it might be Periscope.
Yeah, I'm not sure, but it's I think it's OnlyFans is what it is, OnlyFans.
Okay.
And so OnlyFans is a platform where you can – you know, you can have your own private room and your fans come in. They pay a monthly subscription to see whatever you want to show them. And so, you know, I mean, we live in a different world. Everything is available. Everything is available.
No, totally. And I definitely agree with you. It's a different world and all that. And I do want to come back to the business aspect. But before we get to that, what are some of the things that you think you learned from your entertainment career that you even bring to your business career? So whether that was your work as a cover, or whether that was your work playing Elizabeth Taylor or some of the other things that you've done in the entertainment field, what are some of the things that you gathered from the entertainment side of your life that you now bring to your life in the entrepreneurial space?
Well, I don't have a big fear of rejection because, you know, if you can get rejected in the entertainment business, which probably the hardest thing for people to overcome is, you know, you get down to the wire, you get down to the third callback, and you're almost going to be cast in a part that you really want, and then the next thing you know, the producer's daughter's getting the part, you know. And you think, oh, my God, you know, how did I get this far in the casting? And then, you know, there's a lot of disappointments. There's a lot of rejections. And, you know, I learned to deal with that in the entertainment business. So I think going into the business world, I didn't have a fear of of being rejected, because, you know, I had been rejected by the best, you know. I had the full armor for rejection, you know. Also, I think, you know, I am super personable, and, you know, when you go on auditions, the first thing they say to you, you know, when you walk in the room, tell me about yourself as an actor. You know, and for a lot of people, that's really hard. That's a really hard question to answer. But I remember my agent saying, you know, have two or three things in your back pocket, you know, that you can talk about and stuff. So, you know, I think what I brought from the experience that I had in the entertainment world carried over into business is really just being personable. I think I'm really approachable. I think people felt really comfortable and trusted me. I showed up, and like I said, if they didn't want to do business, I didn't take it personally. You know, you kind of grow thick skin in the entertainment business because you can't take things personally, because things change, and there is a lot of nepotism, and, you know, you're not going to get the part sometimes, and just the way it goes. So I think that carried over, I can talk in front of people confidently because I had to do it on camera. So, you know, I think I can show up and talk confidently in front of people. I can memorize a script, so to speak. In sales, you memorize your spiel, right?
Yeah.
You know,
and sense.
I wasn't worried about messing up because I could improvise. I could just go off script. No one's going to know the difference, you know. So I think just knowing those little tips and knowing those things were very helpful.
Yeah, that's definitely very helpful and everything. The other thing that I know, sometimes people, if they've been involved in L.A., New York, high society and everything, that they sometimes are concerned about is folks that are wanting to get access. I even have to deal with it to some degree, and I'm nowhere near that, but I have some contacts in my area of North Carolina, be that our local mayor and some other folks. But definitely folks are always wanting to access your Rolodex. And, of course, your Rolodex probably includes names like you've mentioned, like definitely Caitlyn Jenner and Mickey O'Rourke and a number of other folks. So how do you deal with that when folks realize that you are, you know, whether it's on the A list or the B list, but that you have access to the A list? How do you deal with folks that are always trying to get in touch with Deborah because they want to reach out to those producers and those folks that they feel that you know or that you might know?
Well, listen, I understand that. I understand that. If somebody comes to me and said, hey, I need a favor. You know, do you have any connections? I really want to get this script in front of somebody or, you know, I have a friend that wants to move to LA and work. Can they get a job in the mailroom? You know, it depends on the situation. Every situation is unique. Yes, I have a lot of really amazing contacts and I'm super grateful for those relationships. But I'm really also very careful on how I use them, you know. So I look at every situation as a unique situation. And if I feel that I can help, then I will. And if I feel that it's not worth me wasting people in my phone's time, I'm not going to waste their time, you know. And, you know, you can only use so many favors, you know. You can't keep going back to the well, so to speak, you know. You got to be really careful and be careful how you, like I said, use people's time and use your favors. You know, you want to think it through and make sure, is this worth contacting this person? You know, is it worth me asking for this favor? You know, and I have to, you know, sometimes I have to turn down a friend or, you know, somebody that comes to me and says, I really need help. I have to say, I'm sorry, you know, I just can't, you know, if I don't believe in whatever it is that, you know. Because I don't want to put my reputation on the line either. And, you know, so I've done that in the past where I've accidentally given somebody access to something and thought that was a mistake, you know, and I shouldn't have done that, you know. And so, yeah, like I said, I've learned the hard way. So that just comes with maturity and time. You know, you learn what's real, what's not, who's just after, You know, you learn about people and what they're after and what they really bring to the table.
Oh, yeah,
you're careful
definitely.
About you're careful with how you use the relationships that you have. I value them. You know, I really do. I value my relationships.
No, definitely. That makes a lot of sense to value those relationships. In a lot of ways, it sounds like your story was that classic rags to riches story as well, because as I was reading up on your bio and everything, you were talking about the fact of coming up from a working class home and also having some very unique jobs, because as I was hearing, now some of them were common, like working in the restaurants and things of that nature, but I also saw where you had worked at a flower shop at a cemetery, and I'm sitting there going like, that sounds like a very interesting job for a teenager to have. And also, if you could share a little bit with our audience about that part of your story as well, the kind of the growing up years and the rags to riches aspect.
Yeah, you know, I did not grow up, you know, my family, we did not have money. We were lower class, right below middle class, I would say, somewhere in there. You know, we got by. We lived in an apartment. Both parents worked. My mom and dad got married very young. My mother was 18. He was 22, my dad. And they didn't have any tools. They didn't know what they were doing. And, you know, they did the best they could with what they had. And I really didn't understand that until I had kids and I was able to look at, you know, kind of the sacrifices that they made and go, oh, shit, you know, this is tough. And so, you know, growing up without any money, my mom worked two jobs so that I could ice skate. I grew up figure skating. And then when they got divorced, there was just no money. And I remember I went to live with my dad for high school, and I went to a pretty sketchy high school in Hawthorne, California, called Lusinger. And, you know, I went to my dad and I said, I don't have any clothes. Like, I don't have any shoes. And, you know, my dad, he just looked at me and said, well, then figure it out. Go get a job. And I'm like, shit, you know, what am I going to do? And so my friend's mom worked at Inglewood Cemetery, and she got her daughter and I jobs, and we literally cut flower stems and arranged flowers, and then we'd go out on the golf cart, and we'd place them on the graves as the orders came in, and that was one of my first jobs because we were getting paid, you know, cash under the table. And then I worked at Pioneer Chicken. I worked at Kentucky Fried Chicken. I worked at Clark's Drugs. I worked all through high school. And, you know, I had a full-time job while I went to high school. My grades slipped. You know, I started doing really poorly academically. And nobody cared. You know, nobody in my family really ever went to college. They all went to junior college. And so nobody really cared. It wasn't like I had somebody over my shoulder going, you're doing okay in school, right? You're going to go to college, right? Like, nobody cared. So I didn't even really, I didn't take the SATs. I wasn't planning on college. And like I said, I had to figure all this out. I remember my dad, I turned 18 my senior year in December. So I was an adult my senior year in high school. And he came in my room with a cigarette in one hand, a drink in the other, and said, you're 18, you can pay rent. And that was like probably one of the last conversations I had with that man. You know, I called my mom and I said, I think I need to come back and live with you. And I left and I moved in with her because I thought, I'm never going to have a life if I got to pay this guy rent, you know. And I thought, here I had been supporting myself all through high school, and now he wants me to pay rent. And I just thought, wow, like, you know, I bought my car insurance. I paid for my gas. I bought my clothes. Now he wants me to pay rent. And I was like, I'm out. And so I moved in with my mom. And, it was rags to riches. You know, it was, the struggle was real. You know, there were no mentors. There was no money. There were, you know, if I wanted food, I had to go and figure it out. And I didn't, like I said, I didn't have anybody asking me, you know, where are you going to go to college? What are you going to do? What do you want to do? Nobody cared. You know, there was no, I didn't have the helicopter parent, you know, wondering if I did my homework. You know, I just got by.
Yeah, it sounds like you just got by and everything. And then I did, like I said, I wanted to talk about a couple of things that have gone on in your life, including the business aspects and everything. But one of those is later on you did getting married to Mitch Gaylord, and I was involved in watching the Olympics. I'm one of those folks that used to watch the Olympics back and forth. So when I saw that that was the X and everything, I was like, I know exactly who that is. That's the person that got that perfect score at everything during the age of Bruce Jenner's run in that same Olympics and everything, but now Caitlyn Jenner. But I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about what that experience was like and being involved in that kind of celebrity space with his Olympic fame and being in that relationship for a while.
We met, he was in the 84 Olympics. I believe Bruce was in the 78. Caitlyn, she was in the 78. Mitch was in 1984. Mitch was the world champion going into the Olympics, so he was slated to win everything. I mean, he was the best gymnast in the world in 1984. So we met in 1989 in acting class because he had just done a movie called American Anthem, and it didn't do so well in theater, so he decided he was going to learn how to act, and I was just finishing up shooting my Playboy issue, and I joined, and we joined the same acting class, and that's how we met. It was a two-year program. We started dating, like, in the second year. And we got married in 92. We had three children back to back. And then in 2003, we unfortunately separated. And by 2004, we were divorced. But that experience was amazing. You know, he was a talent athletically. I was super proud. I still am, really, you know, of his accomplishment. And what he did, I was living in Japan during the 1984 Olympics, so I wasn't here to experience all the all that LA energy that was going on. I was in Japan modeling, and so when we met, you know, I was like, oh my God, yeah. So I didn't see it, but then when I saw videos of him in the Olympics, I was like, oh my God, that's amazing, you know. And it was truly amazing what he accomplished, and he led that team to the gold medal. I think that was the first time the U.S. won the gold medal, actually, in gymnastics, I think. But, yeah, he it was amazing. And I think, you know, it was – we had an interesting relationship because, you know, we were both – you know, it's funny because he, with his athletic background, I grew up figure skating, so we were both athletes. I would have thought that one of our kids would have been an athlete, but we got all artists. They're all in the artistic world, so to speak.
So you got one singer, and what else do you and Mitch have? So a singer, an artist, and a dancer? I'm just guessing.
Yeah, no, we have a singer. We have a recording artist, singer. She plays piano. She writes all her music. And then my oldest daughter is an artist, and my son does YouTube, and he studied acting. And, you know, this pandemic kind of slowed everybody down because they're at the ages where they were just kind of getting into the workforce, and then everything kind of shut down. So, but they're all very artistic, and it's, you know, we didn't get one gymnast or one ice skater. So,
well, maybe the grandkids. Maybe one of them will be the gymnast.
I think it skips a generation. I think you're right.
So maybe one of them. Now, you also had done, and my brother did this for a while. He actually stopped doing it because he got injured both times that he did it. So there's a thing called, like, mud runners or something like that. But it's one of those extreme sports, like, you know, you do the bicycling, you do the swimming, you do all of that. And I think he's done two of them several years back, and both times he managed to break something. So I think me and my parents, as well as some of his friends, were like, no, that's okay, you don't need to do that anymore. So he's given up on that. But what was your experience is participating in extreme sports? Because it does look like you had to train a whole lot during that time that you were a member of the extreme team.
Yeah, no, that was a great, I have such great memories of that time. Yeah, that was the High Tech Adventure Series. And yeah, I trained in mountain biking, running, kayaking, everything adventure. We trained, God, 4 to 6 hours a day. And we, you know, we did about 2-3 races a year. We were sponsored. And one of the former playmates, Danelle Folta, she put the team together. And I remember she called me because she saw or somebody had told her, you know, Deborah Driggs mountain bikes, and not a lot of girls mountain bike. And so she called me and she said, look, I have a team and I really want the Playmates to do this extreme racing. I think it'd be so cool because if people could see a different version of us. And I heard you mountain bike. And I said, yeah, I do. I said, but, you know, I don't do any of those other sports. And she's like, well, I can train you in all the other sports, you know. Just, she goes, get to running, and then by the time you come to boot camp, you know, at least have 3 miles under your belt. So I started training, and I started running, and we did our first boot camp in Puerto Rico because she was filming a TV show there. And we were training with an Army Ranger and doing all those extreme sports and extreme training. And it was such a, it was a great experience. You know, it was such a fun time because, you know, the girls that were involved in that extreme team, we had such a bond, you know, because when you race and train, it's, that's a whole different ball game. And so we really got to bond and we got to know each other. And then when you race together, you know, you're, it's, it is a team effort, you know, because one goes, you all go. You know, it's a team of three, and so it was Danelle, Jenny Lavoie, and myself, and we did about 5 races together, and, you know, you really bond during those races, because if one person's starting to bonk, you gotta lift that person up, because if one person quits, you're all out, you know, and so that's why it's called adventure racing. But, yeah, that was cool. That was a super, super cool time in my life. I enjoyed it so much, and I keep in touch with Danelle, you know, and I tell her all the time, I think we should do a grandma extreme team or something, like we should do something like 55 and over now. Race in a 55 and over competition.
And how much of a club is that whole Playmate family? Because as you were just talking about the extreme sport, it seems to me that y'all probably all, in some degree, have kept in touch, even those that may not have went to the mansion and everything. But how big of a club is that environment and everything, and how much do y'all keep in touch? Because like you said, yours was back in the 90s, but I don't know, do you keep in touch with those that are doing it in, say, 2021, or those that were even predecessors to you, like back in the 70s and the 80s? So how much of a club is there in that environment?
Yeah, it's you know, once a Playmate, always a Playmate. And, you know, God bless Hef when he was here with us. You know, we would see each other at the mansion. You know, that was the thing. You know, he had 3 to 4 parties a year. Sunday night was movie night. So, you know, people, we would go up and see each other at the mansion, especially the girls that were here in L.A. And then, you know, I remember back in, 2007, I think, when Hef joined the Palms Hotel in Vegas, he invited all the Playmates to be there for the opening. And that was fun because that was like a whole huge reunion. You know, I got to see everybody, present, future, past, you know, the whole shebang. But, yeah, no, I actually was on a Zoom call a couple of weeks ago with a lot of the girls, you know, that I knew in the day, and we got on Zoom, and, you know, we catch up, and we, you know, if I'm in New York, there's a couple girls that live in New York, I see them when I'm in New York, and, you know, we stay in touch through social media. But yeah, it is definitely a club, and we're very supportive of each other.
What, just to the common person, what do you think the greatest myths folks have about just Playmates in general and just that whole environment, or even actresses in general? Because I think that a lot of times people have certain stereotypes that they fall into. So I was just wondering, what are some of those stereotypes, and how have you countered those? Because I'm sure that there are certain stereotypes that people have, even that, you know, the mansion. A lot of people had thoughts about what was happening at the mansion. So what are some of those stereotypes that you have had to fight against?
Well, I think, you know, the most obvious one is that all beauty, no brains, you know.
Right.
She's cute, but she's not that smart, you know. And I think, you know, I know that's a stereotype because when I started doing business and you know, people found out that I did Playboy, they were literally, like, they just do a double take to me, like, really, you? Because they couldn't put it together. It's like, you're either pretty or smart, not both, you know. And so I think the stereotype, and also there's a stereotype of, yeah, well, that's easy, and it's not a job. And, you know, there could be nothing. I mean, it's hard work, and I think sometimes people forget that's why they call it show business. You know, it's a business. It's work. There could be days where you're just sitting for hours waiting to shoot something, and it's super tiring, and you just want to, you know, you could shoot, you could be on the set till 2 a.m. and still not have gotten to your scene, or, you know, whatever, and you're not getting enough sleep, and you know, it's there's a lot of work, you know, just the, you know, I had a little bit of, you know, I did a little bit of acting, not a lot. I have, you know, some experience, and I would say, you know, the hardest part is, you know, memorizing lines, showing up ready to go in character. And you get directors that don't want to give you that extra shot. You have one take to get it right, you know, and so it's work. And so there's a lot of stereotype of it. It's so easy. Everybody wants to do it, and it's not easy. And I think that's when people, you know, people drop out, you know, because it's not easy. It's really, it's draining, and it, you know, and it's your brand, you know, you're branding yourself. That's what I'm always impressed with actors and models that have gone on to really be an entrepreneur and brand themselves and start a full-on business like Kathy Ireland, fucking multi-billionaire, you know, what she's done. She created an empire, really smart. And, you know, it's those are to me the impressive, you know, stories.
Oh yeah, definitely. Kathy Ireland is an amazing lady, and even the modeling part is not as easy as people think. Because I just think about it, and I've had some friends that are photographers, and one or two that have been models as well. But it definitely seems like just to be under those hot lights is not easy. Because even when I've done MCing, and I've done some MC work, that even those hot lights can be a hardship as well. So I think a lot of times folks just see you on the stage or on the catwalk, and they assume that it's easy. And, or they see the magazine fold, whatever it is, whether it's in Playboy, whether it's in Esquire, and they just assume that if that was a piece of cake, you just got somebody to take a couple of shots and it was a done deal. But I don't know that people understand that those lights are very intense and very hot, and you have to sometimes be under them for hours on end.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's work. It's work. W-E-R-K. Work.
So they need to understand that it's work, because a lot of times folks are like, that can't be all that much work. I mean, what is it? All they got to do is just put on a happy smile, and even that can be difficult, because I'm sure there were days that you were taking pictures that you might not have been all that happy, whether you were upset with your kids, upset with your spouse when you had one, or upset with just life in general. So sometimes you have to, I'm sure, turn on the switch even when you're not in the mood at that particular moment. So I'm sure that's definitely happened in your life where you've been there going like.
And you really sacrifice a lot too. You know, when I was really working a lot, there was no, you know, you have to go to bed early. You got to look good on camera. You know, there's no social life. There's no, you know, that you see, I mean, it's pretty prevalent, you know, with celebrities getting divorced and not being able to stay together, because it is, you know, it's kind of your brand, your gig, and you're on your time. It's a lot of work. And so a lot of people, it's hard to be married to somebody that's in that business, really.
No, I can definitely understand that, and I know some people, they actually opt not to be with somebody in that business, because I've got friends that are, like I said, musicians and singers, and they prefer to, you know, like, date or be involved with doctors, and I know doctors and lawyers that sometimes don't want to date doctors and lawyers. They'd rather be with somebody in the arts for exactly that reason, because they want to be in different realms. They don't want to be in the same realm. So I don't know whether that's been your experience as well, that you preferred being with people that were, say, outside of the insurance game or outside of entertainment when you were in the entertainment field, or whether you just kind of like went with the flow based on your feelings about that person at the time.
Yeah, you know, when I was in that whole scene, you know, it just, you know, you I find that you date who you're in proximity of. You know, I think, you know, my husband, my husband, I should say, you know, we met because we were in acting class. We were in proximity of each other. I think that in any business, in any situation, in any, you know, in any situation, you're whoever you're in proximity of is who you're dating, you know. It's just, it's easy. I mean, look at Elizabeth Taylor. She married the guy she met in rehab. I mean, because they were in proximity of each other. So I think it just really, you know, for me, I don't have so much of a, I'm not going to date this. I'm more about this is who I want to date. And this is what might want my life to look like. And then, you know, I put that in the universe and then, you know, that's, I hope who will show up is who I've kind of manifested.
No, that makes a lot of sense, and that's definitely probably the best way to do it in that sense and everything. Now, one of the other things that you do in your life is you also do some motivational speaking, and I know some other folks that do motivational speaking as well. So what is kind of the curse or the crust of your motivational speaking message, and what do you think is the message that resonates the most with your audience when you're doing motivational speaking?
So, I just started that path right before the pandemic, and I did a couple of speeches right before the whole country shut down. So I was just getting on a roll, but the first live talk that I gave was about no means maybe and how clients today are not treated. You know, we live in a world where you get put on hold. It's hard to get anybody on the phone to give you the service that you deserve. And, you know, and then I talk about that. I talk about adding value to your clients and how you can go above and beyond and be available to your clients. And then I talk about, you know, what I talked about earlier is no means maybe, and to not take no as a final answer in sales, you know, that no is maybe. You just put it aside, go to the next, and you work off that worksheet, you know, and it's come back to it. When you have a fresh pair of eyes, you know, and you don't dwell on things that don't go your way, you dwell on the things that are going your way. And so, you know, that's basically what I talk about. I don't talk for, you know, I didn't talk for a whole hour. I about 15, 20 minutes, you know, and I talk to family offices about life insurance and the benefits of it, how it's a tool to create and preserve wealth. And, you know, I'm fortunate enough now that, you know, the clients that I have are, you know, affluent, wealthy people that have estates that need those tax benefits that life insurance provides. So I talk a little bit about that and just kind of blend that all in. And then, you know, now it's kind of switched a little bit because now that the pandemic and I decided to write a book, and now I'm kind of doing a funny, more like, you know, hey, I was a playmate. And now I'm a businesswoman, you know, and it's like you can reinvent yourself and you can be whatever you want to be. Anytime you decide, kind of what I talk about now.
And speaking of being a businesswoman and being successful in that regards and everything, how important do you feel it is to get involved with business organizations? I know that here in North Carolina, we've got several chambers of commerce. We've got, like, of course, Toastmasters and Rotary. And then there are, like, even those business networking groups, some of them that are even women-oriented, where they will meet, like, you know, say, the first Wednesday or the first Monday or whatever, and do those networking kind of business communities. So in the business community, how important do you think it is to be part of those organizations?
Ah, huge. Brilliant. Absolutely. A must. You know, because in business, you're networking. You know, the more tools that you can use, the more organizations that you can belong to and go to those events, that's so key. I love it. There's one that I really love. It's EO, Entrepreneurs Organization, and, you know, and I love Toastmasters. I love all of that. You know, it's there, you know, there's an unlimited amount of resources out there, and why not get involved in as much as you possibly can?
No, I definitely agree with you in that. And just, even coming back to the insurance and everything, are you oftentimes shocked with the amount of people that, I don't know whether they're expected to live longer than they actually may live or they just don't think that it's important, but are you oftentimes shocked by the amount of people that don't have life insurance? And how important do you think it is for folks to have life insurance at a relatively young age? Because I know some people that even thought about getting life insurance when they were in their 20s and 30s, even though, you know, the life expectancy has gone up in time, particularly before the pandemic and all of that. But how vital do you think it is for everybody to have life insurance?
Extremely important. You know, I'm always amazed when people just don't believe that nothing's going to happen. And, you know, I tell people I'm in the business of protecting you from an unexpected life event. And God forbid there's an unexpected life event and now you've left behind a husband and kids or a wife and kids. And, you know, where I really built my business was with my girlfriends that were married to very successful men. And I said, do you have enough life insurance? And they'd say, well, what do you mean? I'd say, well, take what you guys spend monthly and double that. And then that's how much life insurance you should have, you know, because if something happens to your husband, what are you going to do? How long can you sustain yourself? You know, and the other thing is when if you don't have life insurance and your husband dies, now you're paying taxes. If you have life insurance, it's a tax-free vehicle. It pays the taxes. So why wouldn't you have it? It's amazing to me that people don't have it, especially people that it wouldn't be a big deal for them to have, and it's just a great vehicle to have in your portfolio. It's a hedge against everything else. It's the one thing that's guaranteed. You know, it's not correlated to anything in the market, and it comes exactly when you need it. If something happens, it's there, and it's tax-free. I don't get it. I don't understand why people avoid it or don't want it. Or I'll have people say to me, oh, well, my estate is going to cover all of that. And I'm like, no, you have to pay estate tax. And estate tax now, Joe Biden, the exemption was, I think, $11.5 million is going to go down to $3.5 million in the next year in the Biden administration. So now more than ever, you know, people need this exemption. They need life insurance to pay for the taxes. And so I'm just blown away that the people, the amount of people that don't have it or don't believe in it. So, but that's a choice, you know. I know that my kids are well covered. If something happens to me, I'm their primary source of stability in their life. So God forbid anything happens to me, you know, they're well taken care of.
Now, what do you say to those folks that are concerned about insurance? And I know this may be more of a medical insurance versus a life insurance issue, but they're concerned about insurance because they are afraid that it won't cover things that they want to have done in their lives. And that can be anything from a woman's right to choose, meaning that they want to use the insurance for, I mean, I'm thinking medical insurance in this case.
I don't know anything about that. I'm a very specific, my insurance is a very specific, I only do life, and, you know, that's it. I mean, mine is super simple and to the point, and a lot of these questions would be for health insurance people.
Right.
Because I have no idea about that.
Yeah, that makes sense. I was just curious because I didn't know how closely related they work together because, like I said, I do know that some people are concerned about, like, because I've just seen friends that have gone through situations, be that abortion, and I've actually got some friends in the LGBT community, so they've even thought about trying to see what they could do with their insurance in terms of, like, spouses and in terms of, like, gender changes and things of that nature and everything, but definitely sounds like life insurance.
I have no idea, but, yeah, that's a great question.
Yeah, because I know a lot of folks have gone through that. I'm imagining that probably if he had life insurance, I'm imagining that Bruce probably had to change, well, Caitlin now probably had to change the nature of, well, I guess the person would still be the same. So if there was life insurance, even if they changed genders, I guess the people that were the original people that were going to get that life insurance would be the same. But that would just be me guessing, since I don't know the man from Adam.
Yeah, I don't either. That's a different show with a different guest.
Different
guest.
That's
not in Deb's den, so to speak. That's out of my realm. Hey, you know, I have enough on my plate. Like, we can pass this one on to someone else.
Yes, we'll pass that one on to somebody else that may have some better ideas of where that goes on and everything of that nature. Coming back to just some of your past and everything, you know, VJs are still popular to this day, and it seems to me that you might have been one of the earlier video jockeys. So what was that experience like as well? Because as I was going through some of the bio, I did see that you did have the privilege of being a VJ or a video jockey, as they are known in the business as well, even though they're not as probably as big as they were even in the 90s, but they were quite popular back in that time frame. So what was that experience like, and how did you enjoy being a video jockey?
It was amazing. It's so much fun. It's totally unexpected. You know, I had just finished doing my centerfold layout, and because I had an agent and because I had already been doing commercials and I'd already been going on auditions for TV shows and stuff, I had that experience. So Playboy came to me and they said, we're going to have a show called Playboy's Hot Rocks and we want you to be the VJ. And I said, right on, let's do it. And so, you know, we had no budget, you know, we had no money, and we just made it happen. And it was so much fun. And, you know, that is seriously one of my favorite jobs, because anything that's kind of unscripted and live, and then you get to interview all these rock bands, and you know, for me, that was probably the beginning of me kind of coming into my own, I should say. Like, I really enjoyed doing that. I enjoyed hosting. I enjoyed having that show, and it was something I really looked forward to. And I only great memories of that. And it's funny, I just I had all those shows on VHS, and I had my daughter like a year ago go and put them all on a thing for the computer, so you can download them onto your computer. And
A zip drive.
Thank you. And so, you know, I said, you know, we were watching some of the shows, and they were like, oh my God, Mom, this is crazy. This is you. And I'm like, well, so yeah, it was kind of fun, you know, I'm glad that I had those on VHS. You know, I could have gotten rid of them years ago, but I still had them. And so we downloaded them, and so now I have them on my computer. It's kind of funny. Brings back memories.
Yeah, definitely. If somebody was wanting to go, and I agree with you with something you said earlier about folks doing sudden pivots. I've got friends that are driving Uber, driving Grubhub, driving DoorDash, doing Lyft, doing things along those lines.
Hey,
so a lot of us
everybody I know is doing that right now. Everybody. I have friends that lost their restaurant, that's what they're doing. You know, I mean, it's, yeah. Got to do what we got to do, right?
Yeah, we got to do what we got to do to survive, and many of us are pivoting in one form or fashion or another. But if somebody was wanting to pivot into the life insurance field or the real estate field, and I've actually heard some friends say that commercial real estate is actually doing quite well during this pandemic, but if they wanted to pivot into these fields, what kind of advice would you give them as one that's been doing it for a number of years and has high sales and all of that? So I guess what I'm asking is, what are some of the keys to your success that you would then pass on to folks if they wanted to get involved in it, preferably not in the L.A. area, since we don't want them competing with you?
That's okay. I love the competition and they can come and absolutely do it in L.A. I work in New York and West Palm Beach and Texas also, so, you know, no competition here. But, you know, any of those things, whether it's real estate or life insurance, I think really is to, if you're going to do it, get your license, learn everything you possibly can. And I would actually suggest, you know, for somebody just starting out, to be an assistant to somebody who's already successful. Be somebody's assistant who's already, if they're doing the job that you want to do, be their assistant, because success leaves clues, and then learn everything that they're doing and work for them, you know, and then you get all this great mentorship and advice, and then you don't have to go and try to recreate something. You get it from the best. You work for the best. I did that in real estate. I worked for one of the best real estate teams in Park City. I learned so much from working. I knew that I didn't want to start a business. I had three kids, and I couldn't start a business. I didn't have the money. So I just went and worked for the best real estate team, and I got so many skills. I learned so much. I learned so much about marketing and contracts and things that I would have never learned. So if you're just starting out and you want to go into the area of real estate or sales or life insurance or whatever field, you know, and you're just starting out, that's my big suggestion is, find who's doing the best. Be your mentor. Who's got the job, the dream job that you want, and go work in the mailroom. Go assist. Get in their circle. Get in proximity of their clients, who they're calling every day. Watch what they're doing, because that's where you're going to get the lessons. You know, that's where you're going to get the you, that's like, you know, you can't pay for that type of on-the-job skill learning, you know. You're going to learn everything that you need to learn.
Yeah, definitely. That makes a lot of sense. You're going to learn everything that you have to learn, and that's very important that folks do that and everything. So I got to ask you the $6 million question that everybody that's listening, whether here or in India, and, of course, Blog Talk Radio is a global community and everything. Does Deborah need an assistant? So I'm sure that somebody's listening and probably asking, is Mark going to ask that question? So, yes, Mark has asked that question. So if somebody's listening and they want to work for you as an assistant, is there that possibility, and how does one go about becoming said assistant?
Well, there's always a possibility. Life is about possibilities. Life is about opportunities. There's an abundance of opportunities. So, yeah, of course. I'm always looking. Nothing would surprise me anymore, you know. That's how the universe works, you know. So, yeah, I would say that. And, you know, if anybody wants to contact me, I have a website, which is www.deborahdriggs.com. And on my Instagram page at Deborah Driggs is really my whole journey of the past, the present, the future, all of it. It's just all the journey, I'm starting to post little excerpts from the book. And, yeah, I mean, I think that would be the best start, is to follow me on Instagram and follow me on my website, and then, you know, we'll go from there.
It sounds like a plan, so we'll have to hopefully have people listening, and maybe they'll be reaching out to you. Now, in your podcast profile and everything, it was actually podcast is where we had met and everything, it talks about you described yourself, and I've heard other people somewhat describe themselves this way as well, but I'm curious as to what you mean by this, because most times people think that they're either famous or not famous, but you describe yourself as somewhat famous. So it seems to me that a Playboy Playmate would be definitely in the famous category, but you describe yourself as somewhat famous. So what's the difference between, say, fame and being somewhat famous?
Well, I had fame, you know, in 1990. Yeah, everybody, you know, I had my 5 minutes of fame, right? I was on the cover of a couple different magazines, and I had commercials running, and I was being asked to audition. I did the Oprah Winfrey Show. I did the Bob Hope special. I did, you know what I mean? I was in a little whirlwind of fame. But I think once you do something like you're a centerfold, or yeah, that's going to be with you forever. You're going to have that fame forever, you know? And, you know, right now I would say some people remember and some people don't. So I guess that's what I mean by somewhat famous. I mean, there are people that absolutely remember certain things about my career, and then there's people that have no clue who I am.
that makes sense.
So I said somewhere in the middle there, right?
Yeah, that makes a lot
and
of sense.
I, you know,
putting...
and I'm what you call, I am in a place right now where I feel like everything's just kind of getting started. I've taken all my life experiences, I've put them in my book, and I feel like, you know, at this age, I'm just getting started. So it'll be interesting to see where the journey leads me.
Yeah, definitely. And what are some of the tools that you feel that people need, not just you, but people in general, in order to become a top salesperson? You've alluded to some of them, but there might be other tools that we haven't talked about. But what are some of the tools that you feel people need in order to become a top salesperson in any industry, whether they want to sell hot dogs or they want to sell life insurance?
Well, 80% is showing up. And then, you know, you need to write everything down. You need to keep track of your clients. You need to go above and beyond what your competition is doing. If they're sending thank you notes, then you better be sending thank you notes. If they're giving away some special, I don't know, gift, then you better be doing that. So you've got to really be watching what your competition is doing and doing it better. And if, you know, you want to create raving fans. You want your clients to be going, oh my God, you have to use this person because she's so good. That's the kind of feedback you want. You want people to, I mean, I do it. You know, if I use somebody's services and I think they're amazing, I'm telling everybody about it. So you want to have that reputation that people are talking about you and saying, oh my God, she's so great to work with. She got everything done. She did it really fast. She checks in. She makes sure that, you know, I did this, this, and this. She made sure I did, you know, because people are busy. And so you want to write down everything and keep track of everything. Keep track of everything.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Now, we've talked about a couple of times during the show about this book that you've got coming on. So when will the book be released? What's the title of the book? And what are some of the life lessons that you expect people can gather from the book? Because I know a lot of times when people have autobiographies, even when Oprah wrote hers and a number of others have written theirs, there are oftentimes life lessons that are included within those. So what are some of the life lessons that you hope people get from your book? And the title of the book.
So the title of the book has not been decided. It's a working title right now. And the working title is I'm a Late Bloomer. And I think because I learned a lot of these lessons later on in life. So the working title is I'm a Late Bloomer. The life lessons in the book are you get knocked down, you get back up, you know, and it doesn't matter how old you are. It doesn't matter how much money you have. It doesn't matter how famous you are. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what you look like. It doesn't matter. Like all these things that we say, I'm too old. I'm too this. It doesn't matter. If you want to do something, if you want to start a business, if you want to get into business, if you want to change careers and you're afraid because you think you're too old and you've been doing the same thing your whole life, it's never too late to start over and to change everything. And I've had to do it a few times. I'm only speaking from experience. You know, I had to start over a few times from scratch. And, you know, there was a while there when I was saying, well, I'm too old. You know, I'm too old to do that. I'm too old to build a brand. I'm too old. I'm too old. Nobody cares that I did Playboy. Nobody cares. I'm not gonna be a guest for that. And then I started thinking, what am I doing? I'm doing the exact thing that I preach about, you know? Of course I'm not. It doesn't matter how old I am. I can do anything I want, you know? So those are the main life lessons. You can do anything you want, whenever you want. Doesn't matter how old you are. And, you know, the resources come. They really do. You know, I mean, I've had to hustle. I've had good years. I've had bad years. I've been up. I've been down. You know, and I think that for me, the successes for my emotional and spiritual growth have come in my failures. So let me say that again. The growth for my emotional and spiritual health have come in my failures. Those were the times that I was like, okay, we're going to dig deep right now. Growth is going to happen right now. And it's when you don't want to do it. It's when you don't want to get out of bed. It's when you don't want to pick up the phone. It's when you just want to give up. And that's when the growth happens, in those moments.
Yeah, definitely. And speaking of growth, one of the other things that I know that it happens in society, because I've got friends in the TV industry, and unfortunately some of them have actually bent the rules to some degree, because a lot of times TV industry can kick people out when they get to be a certain age and everything, but some of my friends have actually managed to bend those roles, and not just men, but even women that have stayed in their 50s and their 60s as TV anchors and TV personalities here in our local market and all. So, but I do know that there is sometimes a push for the beauty industry and the media industry to be so youth-oriented. But I know for a fact that there are some very attractive people in their 50s and 60s, and I would even argue my dad's age, who's in his 80s and everything, and his lady love, who's going to turn 76 later on this month and all of that. But I was just wondering, how have you dealt with that as you have gotten older yourself? Because, yes, you were a playmate, but at the time you were a playmate, you were in your 20s. You're now in your 50s, and some people may be not recognizing the fact that you're still a beautiful woman. So I was just wondering, how do you cope with the ageism that exists within the beauty and the media industry as well?
Well, you know, I think that aging gracefully is the best way to age. You know, just age gracefully. I have a quote that's on all my social media, and it says, aging gracefully is a full-time job, because it is. You know, as we get older, we have to look at things a little bit different. I require more sleep today than I did when I was in my 20s. I require, you know, more time, quiet time where I sit in silence. You know, I didn't require these things when I was in my 20s. I didn't even think about it. But now I require it. I require it for my mental health. I require it to regroup. I require it to calm myself down when I get anxious or worried, you know. And I also know that what I put in my body, what I eat today, what I drink, if I'm drinking things that aren't going to, you know, that are going to create lines on my face. You know, you can tell a lot about people. You can tell what they eat. You can tell how they live. You know, it's kind of written on our bodies and our faces, you know, on how you, I mean, I can pick people out of a crowd and go, wow, that person's really, really, they're healthy. They're really into their health. You know, and I can tell people that just don't care and that are not healthy. And I think that we live in a time now that's so great, because now you can be any age and be just amazing. You know, you can be 50 and rock it. Well, look at Jane Fonda, who's in her 80s and she's killing it. She looks amazing. She is just, I mean, talk about, like, I just have a photo of her on my desk from an Instagram photo of her that I'm like, okay, this is what I want to look like when I'm 80. Like, she just rocks it with her leather boots and her great, you know, what do you call it, highlighted haircut, and just, you know, she's just super freaking cool. And I think that we live in that time now where you can be 80, 40, 20, and you can look hot and sexy. I know that for me, I'm 57, and I think I feel sexier today than I did when I shot Playboy. I feel sexier today than I did in my 20s, and I think it has a lot to do with the fact that I know who I am. I know what I like. I know what I want. I know what I value. I know what I'm not going to waste time on. Where in your 20s, you're trying to figure all that out. You're confused. You're like, I don't know. Do I like that? Do I want to? I don't know. You know, and you're just like bouncing around. You know, now I know exactly. I know my routine. I know what my day looks like. I know the people in my life. There's something about that that is super, super attractive and sexy. And
no,
I think that's why. You know, younger men are attracted to older women because they can see the sexiness of that assurance that older women have. You know, people are always like, wow, you know, she's a, what do you call it, sugar mama or MILF or whatever you want to call it, you know, but when you see an older woman with a younger man, there's a stereotype, but really, in my opinion, what those younger men are seeing is somebody who's self-assured and has already been through the bullshit and feels more sexy than they ever felt in their life. That's attractive. That's attractive. And so, age is a matter of mind.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. Age should be a matter of mind. And definitely I've seen some relationships both on the men and the women's side where it's the person that's older and the person of the other significant other is 15, 20 years younger and everything along those lines. And sometimes it's a matter of they may actually have more in common than they actually think that they have in common, because a lot of times people will put that stereotype there that they're only in it for the sexual aspect of it. But I find that a lot of times people may have more in common even with their age differences if they're true to each other and if they're true to understanding each other. So I don't necessarily think that all cougars, and that's one of the terms that I've heard people use, are just out to get the young man's body and everything. They may actually have some maturity on both parts that is found to be attractive among each other. So
I must say, this is probably one of the longest radio interviews I have done.
Well, it's a 2-hour show, and we are actually, I was going to tell you that bell was actually telling us that the show was about to end any minute. That's what that bell that rang a minute ago, because the show ends at 9 o'clock.
I've got to sign off, and I've had so much fun. The time just flew by. I'm like, oh my God, it's 6 o'clock. I got to go.
Well, I do appreciate it. I know you've got to get ready to go. One of the things that I try to do for all of my guests is before Dean talks about our network and shares maybe some thoughts that he's got and everything, but before I get off is I still would love to get you on sometime or another on one of the streaming shows, and I'll send you an email about that, and maybe we can arrange that for a Monday or a Wednesday, and those are similar to this, but there's sometimes multiple conversations and continuous conversations, but I definitely would like to have that happen, and that's more of the video interview format versus the audio format, but still a lot of the similar kind of questions and all of that. But one of the things that we do on all of these platforms is we try to let people give their words of positivity, and you shared several of them already, but their words of positivity and their words of encouragement that they would like to share to the global community. And then as soon as you say that, Dean may pop on and say some of his thoughts about what he's heard from you and some of the things that he's learned from the conversation before we get everything off the air very quickly. But any words of positivity that you would like to share?
All the positivity is just get up every day with a purpose and something that you love to do, and it will get you out of bed. You know, it will get you out of bed because you're going to be excited to do it. If you're not excited about what you're doing right now, then you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. So my words of encouragement are find what you love to do and do it, and don't worry about all the other things, the whys or the hows. Just do what you love to do. It'll all work out.
Well, I definitely appreciate it. Like I said, definitely look forward to having you come back either on this platform and definitely on the video one as well. It's been a great conversation. Dean, before we get ready to wrap everything up, I know you've been listening in the background. Any words of thoughts that you would like to share with what you've heard from Ms. Deborah and some of the things that she's been sharing with us? So, Dean, do you have any words of wisdom to share with Ms. Deborah?
Not words of wisdom, but thank you, you know. Outstanding conversation, and we thank you for blessing the show with your presence tonight.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me and allowing me to share my story and my journey. I really, really appreciate it. I hope somebody out there that was listening got one distinction. If they did, then I did my job.
Indeed.
Indeed, definitely appreciate you. And like I said, we'll definitely be reaching out to you to get on some of the other shows as well. But right now, me and Dean are getting ready to wrap it up. So, Dean, you want to let Deborah as well as the others know where they can hear the back plays of this that will be coming their way, the first one on tomorrow.
I'm going to sign off, everybody. I'm going to sign off. Thank you so much. Already. Bye-bye. Good night.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Straight Talk with Dean and Mark, Monday nights at 7 p.m. right here on Blog Talk Radio. Don't forget to catch the replay tomorrow afternoon and Wednesday afternoon at 2 p.m. on the Skyhawk Radio Network. And if you miss those, then we do have replays on Radio Public, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Spreaker, TuneIn, Stitcher, Podbean, Apple Podcasts, Podchaser, Podcast Addict, CastBox, PodFollow, Deezer, GeoSavin, and of course, right here on Blog Talk Radio, where we are part of the Level Podcast Network. You can catch shows such as The Black Girl's Guide to Surviving Menopause, The Chef Gang Radio Show, Funk from the Front Seat, Funk Music with Zach, Learning Unwrapped, Less K-12 Better, Marketing with Rush, a.k.a. hashtag Rush Selfie, Mona Shake in the Minority Reports, Mullings Music and Memories with Mark Lee, The Online Dinner Party with Mark Lee, Plant a Good Seed Podcast, The Reinvention Road Trip, She's on Call, The Mark Lee Show, The Just Podcast, The Spinach Social Hour, Virginia Interfaith Live, WNC Original Music, and Straight Talk with Dean and Mark. Like I always say, when you walk outside your front door, showtime, and the world is your stage. Just make sure that people are not watching a rehearsal. With that being said, it's the six-man Dean Geronimo. Have an outstanding week, and we see y'all in 7 days.
Hey, Dean, before you get out of here, I was just going to ask you something. I think next week we've got another guest already lined up as well. I think this one is coming out of the business community, and they've already been in touch with me about being on. So if I remember correctly, I think that they're out of the business entrepreneurship community and all of that. And I was actually trying to pull up the email so I could remember exactly what our guest was and all of that. But we do have a guest lined up for the 10th, which will be next Monday, and all of that. But, you know, I think that we may have just accomplished something new. How many podcasts out there can say that they have had politicians, entertainers, and yes, we can now say we've also had a former playmate on the air as well. So we just keep inviting all kinds of amazing guests, including a former playmate that shared what it was like hanging out with Help. You know, she was talking about them like they were like running buddies and all of that. So she definitely knew him personally and got to hang out with him and all of that. So we've got folks that have definitely had some amazing experiences. But, you know, she also dealt with a very heavy issue because she talked about working with Van Jones on prison reform and also touched on some of the work that she's doing in human trafficking, which I know that one of your friends has also been involved in as well. So we do touch serious issues, but we've had some amazing guests covering all kinds of backgrounds, including now we can say we've had at least one. And who knows, if there are other playmates out there that want to tell us their side of the playmate world, we would love to hear from them as well. So maybe we'll have two playmates, but we can at least say that we've had one playmate on the Straight Talk show. So we've had all kinds of guests living all kinds of worlds and all of that. So definitely, you know, I think it's fair to say that me and Dean love talking to entrepreneurs, creatives, activists, business people, educators, and a lot of other styles as well. So if you fit into any of those categories or you've got a story to tell, I'm sure me and Dean would love to hear it, and they can get in touch with us and come and share their story right here on this platform. What do you think? Dean, do you think that's a good idea that they can get in touch with us and share these amazing stories? Because we've had some truly amazing stories over these last several years that we've been doing this together.
Yes, indeed. Give us a call.
Please do. So you can reach me at bluesradio@gmail.com, or, of course, they can hit us on the various sites that are out there, like podit.net, podcastguest.com, I believe it is, or, of course, there are a number of other ones as well. Or they can just hit me directly. So if you're listening and you got a story to tell, hit us at bluesradio@gmail.com, or you can also go to this website, and I think one of those emails on our social media goes to Dean, but then Dean forwards it to me. So either way, we'll be having some communications, and we can continue having some great dialogue, and I'm looking forward to more great conversations on next week and, of course, the online dinner party on the streaming platform on this coming Wednesday, and, of course, the re-airs of that later on. But definitely, I'm just thinking that we're having some fun and good conversations and looking forward to many, many more.
Indeed. We see y'all next week.
Peace. Oh, and happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there. I know that your wife is a mother. I know that my mom is a mother. And I know that I've got a lot of friends that are mothers as well. This is Mother's Day weekend, so cannot get off the air without wishing them all a happy Mother's Day.
Indeed. Happy Mother's Day.
Peace.